Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette Online, and this is the TS Radio Network. These shows are brought to you in coordination with Marcel Reed and the Whistleblower Summit, which was supposed to take place this July. Apparently, as I understand it, there's going to be some changes to that because of our current situation, and we are going to have Marcel Reed on one night this next week to discuss all of this and what other options we may have. We're not going to let this drop through the floor, I can tell you that. But anyway, as soon as we know anything, you'll know something, and that's just the way it is. Joining me tonight as a co-host, of course, is Kaz Scaife. Say hi, Kaz.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for having me, Marty.
You bet. Friday night wouldn't be the same without you.
I know. I love Friday night.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Well, with all that's going on, Kaz, all that's going on, one of the things I keep pointing out to people regarding this so-called pandemic, which isn't, if it was as virulent as they claim, if it was as deadly as they claim, if it was racing through the population like they claim, don't you think there'd be dead people in the street? I keep waiting for video to come out on Fox showing them using a skid loader to pick up the bodies. There'd be so many of them. But that doesn't seem to be happening. Everybody who's dying is in the hospital, is in a nursing home, is in a prison, is in a jail, is in some kind of institution where they are captive and, you know, for whatever reason. And this is who's dying. And there's been a lot of talk, Kaz, about, you know, what works, what doesn't work, and this and that and something else, and what they're doing for people. What we found out about the ventilators is, first off, through Health and Human Services, $12,000 per diagnosis of COVID. And if they use a ventilator on them, they get $38,000 in medical assistance subsidy goes to the hospital. Gee, I wonder why they're screaming for ventilators. I don't know that that's the right thing to do or it isn't, but our guest tonight can probably tell us a little bit about that. We've had him on before on the dialysis issue, and he was at the summit this last year, I believe, and we've got him back tonight. Dr. Moskowitz, welcome to the show.
Marty, thanks a lot for having me on.
Oh, you bet.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah. You know, if you met her in person, Dr. Moskowitz, you'd just love her. But anyway, she's one of those people, you know, who's got a good heart. But Dr. Moskowitz, what is it we are missing here with this virus? Anything? I mean, none of this makes any sense to me.
Well, what we're missing with over 1.5 million, maybe 2 million patients so far, what we're missing is a treatment.
Yes. And, well, and they keep talking about these ventilators, but I keep hearing other doctors say that's the wrong thing to do.
Well, it does seem as if your odds of survival shrink markedly once you're sick enough for a ventilator. You know, once somebody's in an ICU, the minimum cost to the healthcare system is $10,000 a day, and it can be several times more than that. So everybody who actually goes into the hospital just for oxygen by nasal prongs is already racking up at least $5,000 a day, and then once they get transferred to the ICU and intubated, put on a ventilator, it's easily 10 to 20K a day. So the people who are surviving as well as dying are racking up bills in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Oh,
which
wow.
Wow.
Seeing to the epidemic. I hadn't actually thought of it before tonight.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I just, and I see, like I say, I can't get away from it. It's like it just keeps hitting me in the face. The people that are dying are in the hospital or a nursing home or one of these other institutions. And I, something about that keeps waving a big red flag at me. And this just doesn't make sense to me. And
well,
it has to, it's got to do with the treatment. Go ahead.
Well, or lack of treatment. I mean, if you actually a treatment, lack of treatment gets you on the ventilator. If you actually had a treatment that worked and could keep people off the ventilator and actually keep them out of the hospital, if you could treat this disease as an outpatient, then it would cost a whole lot less. For one thing, you wouldn't have to have people stay home. They could actually go back to work. And for another, you wouldn't be spending an arm and a leg on hospitalization costs.
Right. Right. I just don't when I hear about these medications they're bringing out, and the one I can't even say the name on it, it's some sort of, sounds like a quinolone to me. And that hydro, whatever it is.
Hydroxychloroquine.
Okay.
Right, so the WHO has been pushing hydroxychloroquine, which, you know, the only paper I've seen on it so far is underwhelming. And I have intention of using it. Today, Gilead, yesterday Gilead stopped a study on remdesivir in outpatients, but today there was a rumor that remdesivir worked well for inpatients in a New York hospital. So stock went down yesterday, went back up today for Gilead.
Wow.
With remdesivir, it's going to be outrageously expensive, largely unavailable, and you have to get it intravenously. So, again, it's tailored for the ICU. And it's not going to help population health. For that, there has to be a treatment.
Okay. Okay, Dr. Moskowitz, I know about 2 weeks ago, maybe three, China started using intravenous vitamin C, and we're having success with it. And I know we've got one hospital up in New York that is using it now with good results. How do you feel about that?
Well, my feeling is I was kind of thrashing around a few months ago trying to figure out what might work, and I came across various vitamins, and for a while they seemed like the best thing, but the more I read about COVID, the more it looks like a mast cell degranulation disorder. In other words, more like a peanut allergy than anything else. Really, it's an asthma attack. And just as you wouldn't use vitamin C for an asthma attack, you'd go straight to nasal steroids and then oral steroids. That's what I've been doing for the last week or so with my COVID-19 patients. And it seems to be working okay.
Okay, so you think it's more of an allergic response? I mean, it's along the lines of asthma, and which can be deadly. Yeah, people think that asthma is just a little. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dr. Moskowitz.
No, keep going.
I'm just
going to
say. Most people think asthma is just some little hitch in the road, and it can be debilitating at times, but that it's short-lived and it doesn't cause any real problems, except in a couple of people it might be fatal, you know, if they don't have an inhaler and all this. Asthma is a very serious medical condition, and as a person who suffers terribly from allergies, that thing of not being able to breathe is quite frightening. And so I'm for anything that will help. I don't like, I had a conversation earlier today with drugs like Levaquin and Cipro, which were actually chemotherapy drugs being rebranded as general antibiotics. And their Levaquin most especially is quite deadly. We've got over 600 cases in district courts just here in my state over Levaquin, but they don't tell people that's a chemo drug. Oh, it's just a general, it's a really high gear antibiotic. No, it kills the mitochondria in your red blood cells. Your body can never make vitamin D again. It poisons you just like chemotherapy does. We've lost 22 million people over the last 20 years due to chemotherapy, not cancer, but the treatment. How bad does that have to get for you to stand up and pay attention? So I'm all for using the route of least resistance and what usually ends up being the most effective. So can you talk a little bit about you've got one aspect of your clinic work is prevention, and the second is treatment, and just kind of go into depth about that?
Well, prevention is clearly the better thing to do. If you can keep somebody from having a disease at all, like polio, for example, it sure beats putting them on an iron lung. What we're doing with COVID-19 is basically putting everybody on the iron lung. We're still a couple of years away from a vaccine. And what nobody seems to have done since, you know, last winter, since December in China, is to figure out how to treat the disease, how to keep people out of the hospital. Instead, you know, China was the first to confront the epidemic, and they built a new hospital in 9 days to show off. And everybody since who's gotten COVID-19 has decided to meet it in the hospital and not as an outpatient. I think once the country goes back to work, and I agree that with everybody who wants it to go back to work sooner rather than later, once people start coming out of their houses and getting infected with the virus for real, we're going to have a treatment to keep them out of the hospital, maybe at home, but at least getting better at home. And I think a standard asthma treatment can do that.
Wow. Wouldn't it be great if it was that simple? And it sounds like it actually is. One of the things I came across today, Dr. Moskowitz, was they were talking about, like, nursing homes, why they're getting hit so hard. And they talked about the fact that over the last 20 years they've revamped them, and there is no longer any cross ventilation. There's no windows that open. There's no, it's all this enclosed system. And they were talking about your indoor environment and how toxic the air can become in your own home. So I was thinking about that in relation to the stay-at-home orders. Even in the winter up here where I live, and it gets severely cold, at least once a day, if not twice, I open my front and back door, let the wind blow through here to freshen the air. And, you know, just maybe blow out whatever's in here and might be bad. But it seems to me people walling themselves up in their homes with the doors and windows shut tight is not really a good idea. What do you think about that?
Well, it sounds good to me. Fresh air is always better than stale air. You're right. People who never open their windows, and that's pretty much everybody, either with central heating or central air conditioning down here in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
We never open our windows, and it's like being in the body of an airplane.
Oh.
Ideal for catching everybody else virus. I think this virus is inescapable. I think we're all going to have antibodies to the virus before too much longer, before, say, another 6 months. And the only thing that's going to keep – so this quarantine business, you know, has managed to basically not flatten the curve but delay the spike. I think we're still going to have a spike. And it's not going to be a flattened curve. It's going to be a very high spike, except that I hope people will have learned how to treat this illness so that the number of deaths goes way down, goes down by 100-fold from 3% down to influenza levels of 0.02 or 0.03%.
Yeah. I just think it's unfortunate that things are going the way that they are because, and I'm no expert in anything, but it, you know, looking at this from a common sense point of view, we're doing all the wrong things. It just seems to me we're doing all the wrong things, not to mention terrorizing the country. And we've all had colds before, and that's basically what this is in its simplest form. Why all this hoopla and carrying on? And during the flu season, we lose far more people during the flu season. We don't shut the country down over it. You know, you take a risk. Some people are stupid enough to get a flu shot. I don't vaccinate. We do not vaccinate. No, no, no. And then they're talking about coming out with this vaccine that they had to have had in the works before this was set loose in order to be talking about having a vaccine relatively soon, knowing what I do about vaccine creation and manufacture. That should be at least 2 years away. And yet here they're talking about we'll have it out soon. No, I don't want your vaccine. To me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's illogical to let yourself be intentionally infected with anything and think you have any protection. That doesn't make sense. The only thing you might have protection from is what was in the vaccine. And that isn't what's running wild. So where's the logic in that? I don't get it.
Well, these are mutable viruses, meaning that what you see today is not what you're going to get a year or two down the road.
Right.
And or even a month down the road. And so if you vaccinated against a 8 amino acid stretch of a peptide on the spike protein, let's say, and one of those 8 amino acids changes over the next few weeks or months, then all the antibodies that recognize that epitope are going to be worthless and the vaccine will fail. I actually agree completely. I think for highly mutable viruses that change every year, like the influenza vaccine that only protects 30 or 40%, and is based on what a best guess as to what is coming next year based on what came in the past. I'm not impressed by the influenza vaccine. HIV has been unvaccinatable, even though Fauci's been trying for almost 40 years to design a vaccine. And now with these coronaviruses, which mutate like crazy, not as much as HIV, but certainly a lot, enough to make any vaccine kind of a hopeless affair.
Yeah.
I mean, if you got vaccinated against SARS-1 from 2003, it wouldn't help you at all against this current SARS coronavirus, too. So I just don't think the approach is of a vaccine makes a whole lot of sense. And in fact, what kills people is more of a peanut allergy and anaphylactic reaction. And so that's actually what shared in common between COVID-19 and SARS and MERS and the avian flu to some extent. And if you can inhibit that overactive immune response, the cytokine storm that everybody talked about, then you don't actually have to worry what particular virus it is that year. You can just use steroids or something more specific, if possible, and turn the cytokine storm into a drizzle and not die from the virus.
Wow. Kaz, what are your thoughts?
Well, this is all very interesting. I've just been, you know, so busy working at a bakery, and now we have a doctor on the line, and he's so knowledgeable. I'm just learning the process of, like, how the vaccine is working and how the different things, like, mutate. And I guess my question is this coronavirus something that really, had we not done a quarantine, is this something that would have been like a bubonic plague, kind of like wiped so many people out? Would that have happened?
Well, bubonic plague was 50%. 30 to 50%. So this, you know, the worst that anybody said was 10% for COVID-19, and that was among essentially 85-year-olds in northern Italy who had emphysema already and diabetes and hypertension and heart disease. So I don't think this ever would have been as bad as bubonic plague. But even if it stays at 3% and not 10%, 3% of 330 million is a lot of millions.
Wow.
So it would have been a lot of deaths. But the thing is, you know, this is a couple million patients already, and there's still no accepted treatment. It blows my mind. How can you have 2 million patients and so little interest in innovation, in finding what works? So what's happening, I'm sure, although nobody's really publishing much about it, I think what happens is come in and they get people are afraid to do anything. They get antibiotics thrown at them. They get existing antivirals thrown at them. They then get intubated when their breathing gets bad. Then their blood pressure drops. Their blood pressure is supported with standard pressors. I mean, it's almost like the intensivists aren't thinking. They're just responding like knee-jerk reactions to, you know, in the same way that they might have 50 years ago. It's extraordinary to me. And the big advance that I'm reading about in how the intensivists treat people is whether they flip them over on their stomach, so-called proning, or leave them on their back. Because apparently there's been a revolution in ventilator care that you can get a little bit more oxygen into people's blood if you flip them on their stomach. I mean, that's the extent of the innovation. I find it extraordinary. We don't have people interested in clinical research anymore.
They're too focused on getting this vaccine out. They anticipate making $40 billion on this vaccine. And so I don't think you're going to see any earnest effort, because they're going to let this get as bad as they can, because then people will be crying, give me the vaccine, I don't want to die, and not realizing that there's probably death in that shot. And that's my opinion. I'm speaking for myself there. But, you know, just like this proning you're talking about, flipping people on their stomachs, it reminds me of hospice, which is in the business of euthanizing a great number of people. And as they increase the dosage of morphine and Haldol, right towards the end there, they'll come in and ask the family to leave the room because they have to do something with the patient. When they come back, what they've done is turn them on their side. Which causes them, as I understand it from families that have been through this, it causes the patient extreme pain and labored breathing, and it gets to the point where they can no longer breathe. We've had four families that said, we just grabbed mom or dad or whoever and put them on their back and elevated their head, and their breathing smoothed right out. And so I'm always worried when people start, you know, flipping people of what, why are you doing it? But like I say, with all of the available and all these labs all over the country, all these research labs and all around the world, actually, and you can't come up with anything to correct this, you know, that doesn't make sense to me. It's another one of those things that the dots don't connect for me. How can this be possible? You're working on a vaccine for what? Yeah, go ahead.
It'll be obsolete in 2 years. I mean, it's obsolete in a year. By the time you get it approved by the FDA, the virus won't be around anymore. It'll be a new mutated version. The vaccine will probably not work against.
Exactly.
I find it so fascinating that that viruses are mutating and changing. Like, I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, with HIV, I heard about it for the first time. The RNA polymerase that copies HIV is so apparently so error-prone. I guess it can also replicate a whole lot faster if it doesn't care about errors. But it just zips through the nucleic acid sequence of the virus and doesn't have a copying, an editing mechanism, and can make strings of RNA a whole lot faster and get the virus out faster and be a more productive virus. And it seems like the big ones that have that cause major troubles are highly mutable. They're you just can't count on them being a stable virus, you know, where you can vaccinate with
you're
one
dealing
thing
with
and that lasts forever.
Yeah. One of the things about vaccines too, that I hear this all the time, and Dr. Andy Maniotis, who used to head up cellular biology and pathology of cancer at University of Illinois, told me this. We were talking about vaccines at one time, and he said, beware of the words efficacy and deficiency. And I said, why? He said, the news and all the reports, journals, everything will report the efficacy of a vaccine and claim it's 94, 95, 96%. He said, what they're telling you is we took a control group that was in extremely good health and we administered it to them. These people most likely not to respond negatively to the vaccine or drop over dead. And he said, so that's it, 94, 95, 96%. He said, the word you want to look for and is the real truth is efficiency. He said, when you apply the vaccine broadly across the population without any filters, he said, now it drops down to 4 or 5%, maybe 6, meaning the other 90 some had a severe adverse reaction or they died from it. And he said, it's one of the biggest con jobs that has gone on in decades is that these vaccines are saving lives. He said, we're making people sick. Just like with the chemo drugs. He said, we aren't curing people, we're killing them. And he said, it's all an experiment. He said, vaccines are the same thing. He said, you're shooting all these toxic chemicals, the DNA of non-related species. He said, mutated virus, fungus, bacterium. He said, whatever, ran through the lab that day, and you're shooting it into people's bodies. He said, it's a toxic waste. He said, what in this made people think they were going to get protected or well or anything else? He said, I just sit stunned over this. And I kind of have the same thoughts about it. This doesn't make sense to me. When you look at the formulas on these vaccines, what they actually contain, it's a wonder any of us are still here. And particularly our children, they get 59 doses before they're 5 or 89, whatever it is now. It's a wonder they aren't little potatoes sitting around. But anyway, I'm not for a vaccine. In fact, the idea they're talking about one scares me. And but see, people are trained. They're well trained, and they're looking, well, if we get a vaccine, then we'll have the magic shield against this. Then why are you afraid of me if I'm not vaccinated? What is it scaring me? I thought you had this magic shield that was going to protect you. And the idea that people get vaccinated and still get sick, well, you'll get a milder version. Well, the flu won't last so long. Says who? Compared to what? I want to know. I just, as you can tell, I'm just not at all thrilled with vaccines. I think it's a crime against humanity, quite honestly.
Yeah, I'm somewhere a little bit more pro-vaccine. I think there's certain vaccines that I'm glad my kids got, but there are other vaccines that I'm not as wild about, like the flu shot every year. But I don't think that the answer to every disease is to find a vaccine against it, like a vaccine against cancer or dementia doesn't strike me as a worthy pursuit. But in this case, what we really should be talking about is the immune system. We should be talking about the mast cell. The same cell that gives you food allergies, peanut allergies, allergies to wasp venom and bee stings, and drug allergies like penicillin. The tightening of the throat, the angioedema, anaphylaxis, sudden death. That's actually what's in a slow, kind of a slow-paced anaphylaxis. It's what's killing people from this COVID-19. Turns out that the nuclear capsid, the protein that packs the virus, that essentially glues the single-stranded RNA of the virus to the membrane that covers the virus on its surface, like the cover of a golf ball. The glue that holds the thing together has a bunch of positive charges at one end of the protein, and then a kind of a greasy stretch of amino acids further upstream that binds to the viral membrane, which is just a greasy, fatty envelope. And the combination of those two things, very highly positively charged, 6 out of 7 amino acids are lysines at the C-terminal, almost at the very end of the protein. And then this very fat-loving, greasy area further upstream lets it fit into a receptor on the mast cell membrane. It's only on mast cells, called the MRGPR X2. Sounds like a fancy race car. And it's new. It's only been discovered just in the last 5 years or so, this receptor. And it binds a whole variety of different things, but it specifically binds this nuclear capsid protein, and it also binds the nuclear capsid protein from the first SARS virus in 2003. And the other thing it binds and is inhibited by is a flavonoid from plants, from fruits and vegetables, a food coloring, called quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, which is a very high affinity inhibitor of this receptor. And so what I'm hoping is that quercetin may actually prevent COVID-19 symptoms in the first place, which would be a lovely thing.
Yeah.
And another lovely thing would be if all the antihistamines that we have, you know, the old-fashioned ones, Atarax and Benadryl, and the new non-sedating antihistamines like Claritin and Allegra, if they helped, and if the anti-leukotrienes like Montelukast that asthmatics use, Singulair, if that would help prevent the COVID-19 from its full-blown effect. In other words, we already have a lot of asthma drugs over-the-counter, really, that people can use to try to prevent getting sick, and up to nasal steroids like Flonase or Nasonex or Nasacort, which they can also get over-the-counter without a doctor's prescription. And then if they still get short of breath and tight chest and pressure in their chest, can't breathe, then they can always get oral prednisone from a doctor. And the trick, though, seems to be to start the oral prednisone very quickly and to take this disease extremely seriously, just like you have to take asthma very seriously. As you know, Marty, you can accelerate from having almost no symptoms or just a runny nose to a full-blown asthma attack and
yes.
having your lungs too tight to breathe within a few hours.
Yep.
Wow.
And you have,
it can happen.
So
even,
you have,
it can happen even quicker than that. It can hit you just out of nowhere, and there'll be just a brief interlude of the shortness of breath and that tightness in your chest, then bang, it's there. And it's scary. It's scary. And
yeah,
the panic,
well, most people,
makes it worse. Yeah.
You have to tell people. I think it's going to be very important for public education over the next few months is for people who've had asthma to tell the rest of the population just how fast it can move and how you have to jump on it, and not to go to sleep and think that you're going to get all this stuff tomorrow, but to actually, you know, make sure you've got your everything you can over the counter that day, that night, and start using it. And the next morning, if you wake up, you're short of breath, you have got to get your primary care doctor to order some prednisone for you and start taking it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you learn very quickly when you have this issue to carry your rescue inhaler with you at all times, everywhere you go, because it can hit very, very quickly, and it's debilitating. It'll just leave you in a very vulnerable spot very quickly. But I wonder if you aren't correct about this, that this isn't actually some, at least to some extent, asthma attacks. Because what you're describing about these people with the virus sounds like an asthma attack.
Right. So I finally have my own COVID-19 patients to learn from after having read about this for heard about it for the last 3 months, I finally get to hear from people what they're experiencing. And it's not strictly an asthma attack. Some people who've had asthma before just get it again, and it feels like an asthma attack. And it's a very tough attack, very hard to shake. And I've had to go up on this one kid who's 18 years old who once spent 2 years on prednisone. He couldn't get off it. His asthma was so bad. And I've just had to double his prednisone over the last week because I couldn't even hold him at high doses. I had to I tried tapering off fast, because that was what I wanted to do with everybody. And it just looks like COVID-19, it doesn't let you taper fast. If anything, you start at 60 milligrams a day of prednisone, which is pretty high dose, and takes care of usual asthma attacks readily. For COVID-19, it, you know, half the patients you have to go higher, or maybe a third of the patients you have to go higher. And this one 18-year-old kid, I've got him on 120 milligrams a day, and finally, you know, he's stable.
Okay.
And so I'll have to taper very slowly. It may take 2 years to get him off prednisone with this COVID-19
wow.
attack.
Wow.
Wow.
I don't know. I think all this is just, I think it just escapes me how we can have what supposedly is the best and most advanced healthcare care system in the world, and yet there, other than you and a few other doctors who have stepped forward and spoken out, the rest of the medical community seems to be sitting in park. I think, Dr. Moskowitz, do you think there are people being hospitalized that shouldn't necessarily be hospitalized? Or would you even venture a thought on that?
Well, my general feeling about hospitals is that they're dinosaurs, and that they're obsolete, and they're profit centers and will not go away on their own. But they're not an efficient place to meet disease. They used to be the only place you could meet disease, because you sure couldn't do anything for anybody while they were at home. I mean, in terms of the Black Death, people just died in their houses and then were buried in these mass graves. Then hospitals
right.
arose so that people could die in the hospitals and be buried in mass graves.
Yes.
And then, you know, then all this machinery came in, like ventilators and stuff, which is apparently the only innovation since the 1918 flu epidemic, is that at least people are dying on ventilators this time. But the real power of medicine is drugs. I mean, that's the only thing that we can do to stay alive. And an understanding of normal physiology and pathology, which is what we spend several years trying to learn in medical school. What I've saw with COVID-19 is nobody thought of pathophysiology. There's absolutely no
yeah.
thought other than just intubate the patient, move them to the
yeah.
ICU, and start charging, you know, 20 grand a day.
Yeah.
So it,
yep.
it's kind of appalling to have 2 million patients and nobody figure out how to treat them. I find that the most appalling, you know, evidence of either stupidity or lack of curiosity or, you know, just the IRB, the whole red tape associated with clinical trials, where you have to
right.
spend months writing up protocols and then wait for the one time a month when your institutional review board meets, and then they kick the protocol back, and it takes 6 months to get a protocol approved. I mean, there are lots of reasons why we don't have good clinical research in this country, but one of them is it's not funded. It used to be funded by the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical
mm-hmm.
industry has been quietly imploding for the last 30 years. And the NIH stopped funding clinical medicine in the 60s. Instead, they've been funding mechanism-based research with model systems like mice. And nobody's actually doing any research with humans. And so we have
wow.
entire generations of doctors who've gone through their training. If they're smart, they work with roundworms, mice, knockout mice. And if they're stupid, they work with patients. But any curiosity is bred out of them. And they're told that they're just dummies and they should be doing what the consensus guidelines are. Like, nobody's encouraged
yeah.
to think for themselves. This is not how medicine advanced. In the 30s, 20s and 30s, docs were solving stuff in their own offices.
Wow.
You know what I find strange? in all of this is about 2 weeks ago here in the central Minnesota area where I live, they closed all the medical clinics. And I thought, what? Then here last week, a major hospital in this part of the country started laying off medical personnel. Nobody's coming in. The day before that, the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, one of the biggest medical facilities in the country, started furloughing employees and cutting the pay of others. There's nobody coming in. And I personally think, and I'm hearing this all over the country, these hospitals, and we've seen video and everything of these hospitals sitting empty. And I think people have finally gotten the message that that's a dangerous place to be. We lose, I think I read in one report, 250,000 people a year to hospital-acquired infections. And we lose another 190,000 to medical mistakes. It's not some place you want to go. And if I, you know, was deathly sick, I'd rather be at home in my own bed, thank you, than to be in a hospital. I just don't, something has happened, but they're losing business. You're correct about that. They are losing business. It's something that is lived past its time, if it ever had one. And instead of being a place where you get health care and you get taken care of and you hope to recover, instead they use these horrendous drugs and treatments on you to cause you more misery than the actual disease did. And people are catching on to that. I don't personally take any drugs for anything. And yet I know people that just take handfuls every day and talk about how bad they feel. Well, look at what you just swallowed this morning. What? Get a clue here. Now you have 9 more problems than you didn't have before you started taking this stuff. And that's something I think really Dr. Moskowitz is hitting a lot of people, is that you take these drugs and you end up far sicker. And then you find out, just like they advertise on TV, that it can cause this, that, and something else, and it can kill you. Excuse me? I don't want that. You know, I don't want that. And somewhere we've gotten off the track, and this has ceased to be about health care. It has become sick care. And we are just basically treated, many people I know feel this same way, we are treated as if we are just experiments. Let's see what this does to them. And I think one of the most recent really horrendous ones were these statin drugs that were causing more heart attacks and strokes than they claimed to have prevented, and artificially reducing the cholesterol levels to a dangerous low. And, you know, it's things like that that people are finding out about, and I think they're becoming very leery. I know I am. And but what do you think about this drugs instead of healthcare thing? I just don't think drugs are the way. You can't, there again, you're ingesting toxic elements, and people are getting sick and dying from them. And they're telling you right up front, this will kill you, you know?
Well, Murdy, you're going to have a hard time getting me to buy that argument. I'm a biochemist by training. So drugs are about the only thing I think we can offer a patient. The trick is to find a drug that works, that doesn't have side effects. And that's actually why I like repurposing drugs, using drugs that we know clinically for new diseases, you know, using steroids and mast cell inhibitors for COVID-19 makes so much more sense to me than inventing new drugs. Use even remdesivir, Gilead's drug, which they made for Ebola, but it didn't work. You know, who knows what the side effects are? We certainly know that the cost is outrageous, and it should never even be entertained for a public health emergency like the one we're in. But what I'm amazed at is I've been writing about this mast cell approach, and innate immune response and cytokine storm on LinkedIn for months. And the only thing that shows up on LinkedIn is how this big name company has you know, united with the WHO or with the Department of Defense or with BARDA to purify antibodies out of people who've survived COVID-19 and how they're going to be distributed through a group of elite hospitals to patients in extremis. So it's just, I find it extraordinary to keep focusing on antibodies and vaccines and all this immunology stuff when, from the public health point of view, there's a much cleaner way to treat this, much cheaper, much more effective, much safer. And you know, in terms of distributive justice, something that everybody can get their hands on and is even over-the-counter. I mean, people can use it themselves, the stuff that I'm talking about. And nobody in public health is mentioning it. I think worse than our research apparatus, I think our public health apparatus is in the toilet.
I do, too. I do, too. I have to agree with you on that. And you talked about why they aren't looking at these things, because the profit incentive isn't there. If you can make $40 billion on a vaccine, why would you, you know, no matter how deleterious it might be, why would you reject that when, you know, you can buy something over the counter? You're not going to do that. And there, I saw too where, you know, speaking of over-counter, I see where they're not recommending that you take any over-the-counter drugs for this. Why?
Well, since when has public health's role been to prop up the shares for Gilead, which is Rumsfeld's old company?
I mean, yep.
Since when?
Yep.
It used to be that public health would tell the public to use cheap, safe drugs. I mean, that they were always looking for that. And now public health is only talking about when the vaccine, you know, just hang in there, keep dying until either Gilead's remdesivir or the vaccine is out. I don't
see there's something
where
wrong.
Did
yeah,
the
there's
school?
Something. Go ahead. Yeah.
I'm done.
This is what bothers me in all of this. To me, none of this is about these people who are ill. It's about who's going to make the money. I have long said we've been commodified. They buy, sell, and trade us. They experiment on us. They do all kinds of things to us, and they sit back and wait and see what happens. And, you know, this is – it's all about money. And it's how much can they make off of us. And anything that you deal with, I deal with so many things, it always gets down to who's making the biggest profit and how much more profit can they anticipate. There's something wrong with this picture. We've lost sight of humanity, for one thing. And people have become very, self-concerned, not like narcissism, but in the sense of well, if I'm not sick, if it didn't happen to me, if it didn't happen to a member of my family, I don't care. I don't care. And you got to get out of that. You've got to get out of that, because what happens to one of us happens to all of us eventually, and in one form or another.
Right.
Yep. And you've got to have a much larger. Quit being so myopic in your thinking, and. But it's just, we got about 5 minutes left with you, Dr. Moskowitz. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, I think, you know, you ended on this profit motive, public health, and that's certainly what I've seen for the last 25 years in the dialysis industry. I was sure that having a way to prevent essentially dialysis would just sweep across the world. And it turns out no healthcare system, whether they're single payer or you know, mixed like ours, nobody wants to get rid of their jobs. The bureaucrats in National Health Services or in Medicare, which is already a single payer for dialysis, they're just as eager to hang on to their salaries as private nephrologists are. So
yeah.
It is bad when people, at some point, I don't know when it happens in med school, but certainly by residency, when people are getting into their first job after residency, people already know that they're going for the money. And
yes.
At some point,
wow.
You may, whether you're going to serve the patient or whether you're going to try to maximize your income. And
right.
I'm afraid that everybody in private practice has made the decision that they're going to try to stay, you know, malpractice while amassing as much money as possible.
Dr. Moskowitz, I have three questions here from you, for you from listeners. And number one, do you think the WHO should be defunded? And number two is, how long will your clinical trial last? And number three is, do you think you can cut the length of recovery time?
So number one, I don't think WHO matters one way or the other. It doesn't matter. They get defunded. You know, I approached them 25 years ago to see if they would help me with getting rid of dialysis. They had no interest. So
right.
I think there are a lot of paid people who go to meetings, pat each other on the back, give each other prizes, and have absolutely no effect on the public health of the average person
yeah.
on earth.
I have to agree with that. Yes.
I don't care one way or the other. Number two, was how long will my trial last? Basically, I'm running consecutive case series until the virus goes underground. So it could last through summer, or if this thing is with us year in and year out, you know, I'll just keep publishing on it. So far, a dozen patients that I've been seeing for a week, and it looks like treating them as if they were asthma patients is going to work just fine, which brings me to the third question, which is how fast can I knock it? And it looks like it's going to be sort of a standard asthma attack, maybe a little bit longer for some people.
Okay.
And what I'm hoping is that the flavonoid that I mentioned, quercetin, or montelukast or Claritin, you know, may hit that receptor, the MRGPRX2 receptor, and act as good as remdesivir seems to act.
Okay.
I mean, if
okay.
So remdesivir got people who were on a ventilator out within a week. And those people, two-thirds of them should have died. Two-thirds should have died, and they should have been in there for 3 weeks. So it was very dramatic from the results that I heard today. So I want quercetin to do the same thing.
Wow. And your clinic, you say, is down there in Florida. And for those who are asking, he is an MD, an MA, and I don't know what OXON is or FACP. Could you explain those real quick?
So I got a master's from Oxford.
Wow. Okay. And you're founder and CEO and CMO of GenoMed in Hollywood, Florida. Dr. Moskowitz, did you want to give out any contact information, phone number,
sure.
Email, anything?
Everything's on our website, genomed.com.
Okay. All right. Well, that's – and I've got a link to you here on the promo, so All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming on. We're going to have you back again.
I learned
again.
So much. Wow.
Oh, yep.
Thank you.
Yep.
My pleasure,
yeah,
Marty.
Was,
thanks so much for inviting.
Yeah, we'll have you back again. We need to talk more.
Thank you.
All right. Well, everyone, I hope you got what you needed out of that, at least got a good primer on all this stuff, and somebody who's talking some sense for a change. We don't know at this point. This thing about it being possibly like asthma or a form of asthma, I think makes sense to me, and knowing how quickly this can attack you, what it can do to you. And I thought that when I first heard that people were succumbing to this and this inability to breathe. Sounded very familiar. And if you have allergies, you know what I'm talking about. I do. I have severe allergies. The older I get, the more of them I get. I don't know what that's about. But they get worse. And this is a lot to think about. I hope everybody will listen to this show. Dr. Moskowitz, again, thank you for joining us, and we will catch you next time around.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Yeah. Yeah.
Bye now.
Okay, cuz, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. I cannot believe how intelligent he is. When I was hearing all the facts and figures and it really makes me think this guy knows what he's talking about. And I'm like not a doctor, and he explained it easy enough for like someone like me to kind of grasp what he was trying to say. He didn't talk over my head. I'm just a baker. Everyone knows that. That's all I do. So a lot of medical stuff could go over my head. I was really impressed with him. It made sense.
Me too.
It also, the one thing that I really thought that I picked up, like, I do think that he thinks that the quarantine, you know, was, you know, it might not be this all conspiracy theory thing that, you know, that 3% of the population would have died. And I thought that was an interesting figure that he shared.
That
this is, because there's a lot of people out there. And I mean, I don't blame him because I sometimes think this myself, but I feel after hearing him talking that this is something that we should all be concerned about. This is like not a conspiracy theory, but yet the point of that we need to look at how to fix the symptoms instead of doing all, you know, the putting in the hospital and making all the money and everything. But what I thought, I think so many people think this is like a hoax, and it doesn't sound like it really it is. And like, why is this happening? And what, you know, I would have loved to like know, did he think this was like a biological weapon, you know, created in Wuhan? I've heard those theories, and you just don't know what to believe because there's so much out there, and you hear it from all ends. You know, what really happened? And, you know, here I am, just a little baker. I have no idea. And he just explained it like, this is what it is. And then when he was talking about like finding vaccines and how they don't work and how things mutate and how, you know, they wish they could find an HIV vaccine, but that mutates so much so that it would never work. He just explained it just so well, I think, for the everyday person.
Yes. I have to agree with that. One of the things we're always afraid of when we get a professional on is that they're going to speak coded language, known only to the field that they work in, you know, and you're sitting there going, what? But one of the reasons I was excited about having him back on again, having had him on the dialysis show with Arlene Mullen, he just talks in, like you say, he talks at a level you can understand. He isn't talking down to you. He isn't trying to talk over your head. He's just trying to talk so you understand what he's saying. And I'm like you. I have no background in any of this. You know, I'm no doctor. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not this. I'm not that. I'm not anything but an old lady sitting out here in Minnesota. So to have somebody speak so that we could all understand what was being said, I think was a great thing. I think it did a lot of this. As far as conspiracy theories go, you know, my that term was coined by the CIA to denigrate, marginalize anybody who went against the stories the government told. And the reason, we don't trust government. I mean, people inherently do not trust the government on any level, is because they lie all the time. And you catch them in one lie, they'll tell you two more. And we have been lied to about many things. The Gulf of Tonkin incident that started the Vietnam War under Johnson, 9-1-1. You can't find anybody that believes the conspiracy theory put out by the government on that one. These mass shootings supposedly that take place, you know, they won't tell us how many of those kids have been on psych drugs and been in therapy, and maybe we're geared to do that, but I notice those always show up right before they're going to vote on a Second Amendment rights bill. That always happens right before that. See, that way you'll get really excited, you know. And but they just tell us so much, and now we have a president who absolutely is a pathological liar. I don't honestly think the man's intentions are bad. I think he can't help himself. He's uneducated and doesn't care to learn. And so you see the results of that. You get this twisted conversation that's ongoing. It's on running on all the time. And one day he says this, and the next day he says that. And for the population listening to him, this is the president of the United States. And they get scared because this man obviously has some issues. And he's supposedly running the show. And, you know, it'd be like if you had Bozo the Clown up there telling you, you know, we're going to go to war with so-and-so because I decided. You know, it gives you the heebie-jeebies. And so whatever his intentions are, I don't think he can help. But I think it has helped generate this paranoia, this fear, this hysteria that's running. And I think Dr. Moskowitz was correct also in the key to this is keeping people out of the hospital. You know, it's the one place you don't want to, but like I say, we know that at least 250,000 people every year die from hospital acquired infections. It's like, what? What?
Yeah.
And, but did you know that about 160,000 people a year die from malnutrition while in the hospital? Now think about that one.
What
that to
are
me
they
is just,
being fat? Oh my gosh.
Yes. And, it just, yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of things to consider here. And, but I don't understand people becoming this paranoid, this hysterical, this, whatever it is that's going on. I don't understand that.
I think what's happening, Marty, is like, you know, you and I and most of our listeners who, you know, have been abused by a government agency, you know, a lot of people who tune into us where we're the guardianship, you know, talk. And so you already know that your government has done this to you and you've gone to all the agencies and nobody cares. So you already know the government's out to get you. And so, but the majority of the people, you know, obviously they never believe any of this. Oh, no. And so right now I think they're getting a little taste of what we are all know already and are seeing that maybe the government doesn't always have their best intentions. It's always going to be about the money. And we know that. Yeah. And it's, you know, money makes, there's a song, money makes the world go around. And I guess that's pretty much what it is for them. And it's just, I think the regular Joe is just getting a little taste of what we already know. And maybe, I wonder, Marty, are like the people like in the guardianship, are we handling it better than everyone else? Because we've been like, you know, it's already been soaked into our skin a little bit. And then you just go, uh-huh. Versus somebody who's just been like thrown in the cold water, like, whoa, what's going on here? You know, I wonder.
Yeah. Well, I think when people get sucked into this guardianship probate court system, and I think parents who get sucked into family court and foster care and watching their kids be forcibly adopted to someone else, I think it's that shell shock of sorts. We don't have a judicial system that we can trust. We know that.
Right.
I mean, daily, numerous reports daily of the corruption in these courts. And I think one thing that
right.
we need to do as Americans is, number one, get rid of these bar associations which have monopolized our judicial system, our justice system. And number two, hold these people accountable. You're supposed to be the expert in that room. There is no excuse for you
mm-hmm.
to go against the law or to misinterpret. Now, that can happen. I do understand that can happen. But to intentionally misstate the law or say, well, I know
right.
the law is this, but I'm going to do this instead,
mm-hmm.
you need to be brought up on charges. You have a very special job, and that is to make sure the law works for everyone. And
right.
so I think those
work it for themselves.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
And who's
we,
ever
we,
paying
we
them?
We know we're onto it. Yeah, we're all
yeah.
onto it. How is now that everyone
yeah.
is sitting at home watching Netflix? How is our favorite Netflix show, Dirty Money, doing?
It's
Guardian
doing
Inc.
quite well, actually. Yeah. It stays on the trending list, and it was up on the top 10 there for 3-4 days, but it's staying on the trending list. I've been watching it. We've had a lot of response over Lisa Ballinger's appearance in Guardians Inc., which is episode 5 on Dirty Money. And I recommend, if you haven't seen it, to go watch it. It's just the tip of the iceberg, and we're hoping Netflix can do more on this. You know, there's
I hope they
some
are
going to
do the assholes. You know, speaking of the
yeah.
assholes, if Netflix is listening, just this week I have learned of 3 more victims. And so my
oh,
name
wow.
must be out there, Marty. And they I shared you with you, you know, obviously I'm not going to share it out loud for everyone. But, you
right.
know, they're finding me. And I'm
yeah.
very excited. Of course, I send everyone who comes to me the very first and foremost place that you need to go is the National Association Stop Guardianship Abuse. They are keeping
yeah.
track of everything. And then I do
yeah.
love to talk to people and just let them know, no, you have not done something wrong, the way, you know, they demonize everybody, and to let everybody know,
right.
yes, you are correct. Something wrong
yeah.
is happening. And I think that gives people comfort when they're going through it. And so if I can do that for others, then I'm honored. But I also, that is the number one thing, I refer everyone to NASGA. But if
yeah.
Dirty Money's listening, just 3 in a week, like, we really have a great otthole show for them to just, those otholes.
Yeah.
They just spreading
yep.
their wings, going into other counties
yep.
that we're finding out about.
Yes. Yeah,
know,
it's just,
just,
you know, because when I was first dealing with the guardianship issue, the families always told me, when we went to an attorney or we got in front of a judge or whoever it was, they always said, well, I've never heard of such a thing. Well, nobody's ever said
yeah.
it, politicians especially. I never heard. It must be an isolated incident. Well, you must have
no.
done something wrong, you know, and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
But here we are 12 years later. The cat's out of the
mm-hmm.
bag. You can't
yeah.
deny this is happening. What bothers me is this is widely known now. I mean, there are tens
yeah.
of thousands of people involved in this, subject to it, and they can't say they don't know anymore. Here in Minnesota, we have bills coming out where they are codifying into law. It sounds like an elder protection bill. Oh, this is going to be wonderful. But they're codifying
mm-hmm.
into law the legal right of the guardian to isolate for no apparent reason, to store someone in another state even. No reason why they can't be kept here, but
right.
To change wills, to change beneficiaries, to discard wills, to break into trust, it's all written into these bills, making it legal, not lawful, but legal,
mm-hmm.
and so that they cannot be sued. Now, that's your government
right.
working against you and on
yeah.
behalf of these predators. So, you know, this is something we all need to keep an eye on. We all need to be talking about and hold these people accountable. Like I say, you can't deny anymore. Say, oh, well, it's just, you know, an isolated, you just misunderstood something. No, I didn't misunderstand anything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and saying, well, it isn't a big issue. And I have real problems. I had a legislator here in Minnesota who said, you know, I'm dealing with really important issues. And I said, really? I said, so elderly people being kidnapped, isolated, and robbed, and then euthanized isn't an important issue to you. What are you working on? Fracking? Copper mining? What?
Yeah. You know, and we've gone to, like when, what's the guy's name? Bob Casey. He's just a big scumbag out there in Pennsylvania. We all went to him. Oh, yeah, yeah. He's, you know. So what was the guy running against him? I can't remember the guy's name. Anyway, we go to the guy running against Bob Casey, like, hey, we got some dirt. Look at what this guy turns his back on. He doesn't even, like, he doesn't care. He could, I'm like, if you're in Pennsylvania where, like, a third of the population are elderly, and you would bring that up against your running mate, you would win the election. You would win. Yeah. And I'm like, I thought, you know, we're going to get that, Bob Casey. We're going to go to the guy running against him and give him the dirt. And we did that. And he didn't care. But you know what? He lost the election. It's Bob Casey still sitting there. But, you know, I don't understand. Well, why didn't you, that's like, what is it, like a swift boat? Swift boat, Bob Casey, and let all of us come forward and say what he doesn't care about. And then see how that third of your population votes. But
there was go ahead.
No, I mean, I can't even remember the guy's name even, but I couldn't believe it. So what, Bob Casey is a Democrat. You know, I don't care, Democrat, Republican. But this guy that ran against him was a Republican and, you know, went on to send him as much stuff that he just didn't care. But I kind of think it's funny that he didn't win the election because, you know, you had the goods on the guy and you didn't have, you know, enough balls to bring it out. You didn't deserve to win. The other scumbag's still there, and I guess. No, sometimes you cut the head of the Hydra off, another head grows out.
Yeah, there you go. Years ago, we had an advocate for her brother named Tracy Miller, and I
knew
talked
Tracy.
Quite a bit extensive. Yes, and she passed away, but she had gone to Bob Casey numerous times over what was happening to her brother, who was disabled. And I believe he had an injury, if I remember correctly, and I can't remember what it was, but I remember Tracy. And she had called me the one time just screaming about Bob Casey and how he'd just sit and lie, or he'd promise he was going to do something then didn't. And, you know, and then she found he would be working with the people that she was fighting with, you know, trying to save her brother. And, yeah, he's got a bad reputation. He's another one of those like Mitch McConnell or Nancy Pelosi. You can't figure out how they keep getting in there. And I think those three people alone are a testament to the fact those machines have got to be rigged. Because especially like Mitch McConnell is absolutely hated in Kentucky. Hated. And yet somehow he wins every time. Nancy Pelosi, despised far and wide, but somehow she wins every time.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are with Bob Casey. This is a man who is a do-nothing for his constituents. Absolutely does nothing to benefit the public that put him in office. And, you know, he's of the same ilk. He's going to do what's good for Bob Casey and screw you. And makes you wonder what all he's doing for himself.
And he sits on the elder task force. You know, they these senators are on different like committees or whatever. He's on the elder, the Stop Elder Abuse Committee. And I just think that's a big joke. I mean, that was one of the real reasons why we all went to him. Like, this is happening in Pennsylvania.
Yep.
You sit on this committee, and he doesn't care. Doesn't care.
No. He sits on the committee because he gets probably somewhere around 70,000. For the annual meeting that they have just for taking a seat in that chair. And you look at everybody that's on that Senate Committee on Aging. They meet once a year about the same time. They are a non-regulatory committee. They can't do anything. And so why they exist, I'm not sure. But people go and testify in front of them and I did one time some years ago, but realized very quickly I'd made a big giant mistake. They have no authority or power to do anything, but this is for public consumption. They can say they have this committee, and oh, it met. We didn't do anything, and nothing resulted from us meeting, and we can't do anything with the reports we got from the public, but we got paid, and so, you know, I mean, it's just unbelievable what goes on. We got about 9 minutes, Cause.
Yeah.
How are you holding up on your business there?
Hey, I still have some listeners' cookie orders that we have been working on, and we don't take money until I'm ready to ship. And we will be making phone calls and getting the rest of the cookie orders shipped out. We're finishing up all that biscotti, shipping out again on Monday and Tuesday. And now, Marty, you got some of that biscotti. Someone shipped you a gift. Did you dip it in the coffee? You got to dip the biscotti in the coffee.
Yes. Yes, I did. And thanks to you and my friend, I've gained 6 pounds.
Is it 13 more to go? Because have you heard we're all supposed to gain the COVID-19? Get it? You know, the freshman 15. You're on your way, Marty. You got 13 more pounds to gain. And you could afford to gain that 19 pounds. I think you could gain it. You are very slender. You are very slender. I think that if you gain the COVID-19, you would wear it well. Me, on the other hand, not so much.
Cause you saw me. I'm a short, fat lady.
No.
Oh, my God.
You're tiny.
No,
I saw you. I saw this tiny, tiny Marty. Skinny Marty who could gain the COVID-19.
It's about 3 years ago out at the summit. Several people from the USDA, Lawrence Lucas, Ron Cotton, and other people were standing outside waiting to go in for their panel. And I was standing there talking to them, and there was a lady that came up, and she was kind of listening to the conversation, and she looked at me, and she goes, "You're Marty Oakley?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, you're only this big." And I looked at her, because I consider myself a large woman. And I said, "What?" She said, "Well, you ain't but this big." And she said, "But boy, you sure can talk. You sure got a big mouth." And I thought, okay. But no, I don't see myself as small. I see myself as quite large. And, you know, I've always felt like the biggest woman in the room. And I don't know. It's just, but, you know, I ate my biscotti. I've got 3 pieces of it left. And I have to pace myself. Because when I got on the scale and it had jumped out, whoa!
You have 13 more pounds to go to gain the COVID-19. So you're fine. You're going to have, someone else should send you cookies. Get a hold of me and order some cookies for Marty. She's only have 3 left. I have to say the fruit bouquets, we do those fruit bouquets. We do them for 1-800-Flowers, Amazon.com, and Sherry's Berries. And it was the busiest Easter season in the history of the company. And these fruit bouquets are keeping us in business. Today, this all we did all day long was make fruit bouquets. And it's just so funny. My husband's like, I'm like, oh, you know, we have all these, been making fruit bouquets all day long. And he goes, you know, no bleep. He says, I can't believe how many fruit bouquets you guys are doing. I'm like, I know, it's great. So it's almost like all of our sales are really, I mean, we're doing dinners now, but these fruit bouquets. So anyone who has signed up to sell fruit bouquets, you are probably so happy right now that you decided to do it, because everyone's sitting at home and they're sending gifts out. And it's so fun, Marty, to just go up to, you know, and we have our masks on and our gloves when we're delivering. But it just makes people happy. You know, I'm not knocking on the door to, like, get a donation or do, you know, whatever. Sometimes people, they don't know who's there and, you know, who is it? And I'm standing there with my balloons and my fruit bouquet, and their attitudes just change the minute they open the door and they see and – you know, I'll say happy birthday or whatever. And it's a very healthy gift. And you can't eat flowers, but you can eat edible pineapple flowers that we deliver. So that has kept us very busy, almost too busy. So I'm grateful for that. We have not seen a penny of stimulus money. So if everyone thinks all the businesses are getting all this money, I'm waiting to see that happen. I applied for that SBA disaster loan that's supposed to give you 3 business days. Well, it's been 3 weeks, Marty, and I haven't seen a dime, not even a penny. So I'll let you know if that actually happens. And you know what makes me sad is how many people might have paid some bills thinking that money was coming, and now they're in big trouble.
Yes,
because it didn't come.
Well,
you know, the rumors.
Another part of that came out. No, but the bank written into that stimulus bill. I think it's unfortunate they didn't do this with these corporations and banks. They can deposit the money into your account, but the bank can seize your money to pay outstanding bills. So you, even though the money might have gotten there, it'll go to your creditors. And I don't know if the bills have to be delinquent. I don't know. But they can seize that stimulus money to pay creditors. And I thought, what a
That's
dirty,
awesome.
Low-down, rotten trick to pull on people. You took their job away from them. And I'm sorry, I just don't agree with any of this. I really don't. I don't agree with anything that's happening or the way they're handling it. But there again, I'm not an expert. So these people obviously are way smarter than me. I know they are because look at all the money they're making. And they're calling the shots. So, you know, there you go.
You
Todd
know,
Cosby,
I,
just got a couple minutes here. Go ahead.
We got a couple minutes. All right.
Yep.
I guess I'll real quick. WRA, Wisconsin Restaurant Association, put out a study. 30% of restaurants that closed will not ever reopen in Wisconsin. Another 30% will probably make it, and I'm feeling confident we'll be in that 30%. The other 40% is unknown. And just think, when it's time to go back to work, what these restaurants have to do is all the food in the cooler, it's done. Two months later, you don't want to eat that food. It's done. It's garbage. It,
right.
You know, who knows what happened to it. They are going to have to put in a big, several thousands of dollars worth of product order just to get up and running.
Yes.
And if you don't have the money to get that product order in, it's different than if you know, like you're a Hallmark store and you have cards and knickknacks sitting on the shelf. That stuff is still good when you open up. But the restaurants, that everything's perishable. You have to repurchase it all. If you don't have the money to repurchase it, it's not happening. And that's the unknown for the restaurant industry, the hospitality industry, which is the second largest employer in the United States next to the federal government. Our hospitality industry has been hit very hard. A lot of middle class America, lower income, that's where a lot of us are getting our employment. And this is the industry that's been hit the hardest. And, you know, just here in Wisconsin, that only they can say for sure they think 30% of the restaurants will stay open, 30 will not open, and the other 40%, it's an unknown. So it has really hit our industry hard. And I really thank everyone who has supported us. It has meant the world. There's a lot of things I can be so grateful for.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that. It's unfortunate they didn't shut the government down. It could have saved us a lot of money and a lot of hot air. But anyway, we're down to the end here. Now, this next week, Marcel Reed is going to be on with us from the Whistleblower Summit one night. I have to get that scheduled, and I'll let everybody know when. But she's going to come on with us and talk about the condition of the summit this year, what's going on. And she said, be doing a
hopefully
internet thing. We'll see.
Hopefully she'll be available on a Friday.
Yeah, there you go. Maybe we can put her on a Friday. Yeah, I'll ask her. All right.
I would love
that.
We've
got 60 seconds. I would too. That'd be fun. And but anyway, everybody, thanks for tuning in. Dr. Moskowitz, thank you so much. This was
thank
a wonderful
you,
interview, and I think it cleared up a lot for a lot of people. And again, these shows are coordinated by with Marcel Reed and the Whistleblower Summit, which normally takes place at the end of July every year. probably not so much this year. And we are sponsored by Rosie's Coffee Bar and Bakery in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Is it Milwaukee? Madison.
Madison.
Madison, there you go. And so everybody, you can call in your orders, have it shipped to you. And
yes,
we will see you all next week. Thanks, everyone, and good night.
Good night.